I don't know, it sounds a bit sentimental, but just the way she had written that ethnography, like almost personifying, like bringing these fishes and these living beings to life, it made me feel sad. I just felt like sad, you know? I felt empathy, like, you know, poor thing.
Hello there, and welcome to Rubens Podcast, a show where I speak to people about their lives over the last decade and the lessons they've learned along the way. If you're new here, some quick notes before we get into today's episode. If you'd like to follow the podcast, you can find us on Instagram and subscribe to our newsletter. On Instagram, we are at Rubens Podcast. And the newsletter is at rubenspodcast.substack. If you enjoy this episode and the podcast in general, you can consider supporting the show by buying me a coffee. But if that's too much, you can leave us a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this. It makes me happy and helps the show reach more people. You can find all the links in the show notes. Okay, with that, let's get into today's conversation. Priyanka, welcome to Rubens Podcast. For people listening in, where in the world are you right now?
Hi, Ruben. I am currently in Bermondsey, which is a few yards away. Not yards, actually. It's a stone throws away from London Bridge. So, you know, I think just for a sort of reference, near London Bridge.
Got it. So if London Bridge was like Stephen's, where exactly are you? For people who are not very familiar with London.
Oh dear, now this is going to sound like, you know, no. Let me zone out. London Bridge is very much, so it's sort of zone one. So London is divided into different zones. It's concentric circles in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be, say, for instance, Westminster, LSE. Lots of people went to LSE.
Mm-hmm.
All of that would be zone one, and then there's zone two, zone three, zone four. And London Bridge would be somewhere in that sort of radius.
Got it.
I don't exactly know how many kilometers zone one kind of covers, just in terms of the center. But I think the center would be like Westminster.
So, okay. Yeah. Got it. So for the average person listening, you live in London, yeah.
Yes. Oh, sorry. That's how I should have started. Like, you know, I live in London. Oh, God.
Okay, got it. And how long have you been there? I know you moved there for LSE right after college and D school. So how long have you been in London now?
2000, I think, 15, 16. So probably like 7, 8 years.
7 years. And what is the scorecard? What do you like the most about living in London? And then what do you like the most about living in London?
What do I like the most? I think it's a very diverse city, and like definitely the diversity for sure. It's one of the most diverse cities of the world. Also how driven people are. Like, I think it's really like, I don't know, a lot of like flapping fishes put together in a cane. So everybody, like, you know, I think you just have to be made of different stuff if you're an immigrant wanting to make it. Like, it's just a different set of value systems, and you want different things in life. So I think I like that energy, that drive. I don't have it so much, but I do enjoy that.
But you seem to have survived without...
Yes, it is survival, I think. You know, I think that's a nice word. It is survival. But it's also like, I think if you don't have that energy, then you have to cultivate it and build it up. But if you already have that, then I feel like the city will really work for you, because the motions will not seem like motions. It can be a little brutal. That's what I'm trying to say.
And have you built that energy up? Do you think you've built that energy up?
Well, I don't know, you know, Ruben. I think fundamentally, at my core, I'm not a super ambitious person. I'm quite chilled out, laid back. I've always been like that since college. I do take my work seriously. I like what I do. But I think I've managed to build it up, you know, bit by bit. But I do live for different things. Like, for instance, probably money is not my key driver. I there are different things, like community would be my key driver, or maybe like other things. So yeah,
you know, I, in the last
maybe a few years, I've heard this term community quite a bit. What do you mean by community is your key driver? What is your definition of a community? Is it like a sense
of
belonging?
I think it's a bit of a hyper-local word in London, to be very honest, for those who don't sort of, who are not living here. And this is, I think, categorically also coming from the fact that I do work for volunteering organizations, working for specific communities. And also I work very closely with the councils. So in a way, like, I think community is within a certain physical space, number one, you know, where you live, the space around you. It's also maybe tied to an administrative unit. You know, there are certain sort of councils and boroughs within London. It's also tied to, like, the people. So there are different, like, layers to understanding this, especially within London context. So in London, if you live here, or even in England, you'd hear this word community quite often. And it's a very important sort of word to organize people's value systems. So I think there are three things to it. One is it doesn't take into account, like, it could be a diverse set of people from different ethnicities, personalities, blah, blah, blah. London is essentially a place of immigrants. So community takes into account that diversity. One, second is that going through the same problems. If you live in a particular area, you will go through the same problems. You might have, like, for instance, knife crime in that specific area. I'm just sort of taking extreme, you know. You might have different kinds of youth problems. You might have different kind of, you know, I mean, I don't know, different kind of like community problems. Yeah. Youth problem is one of them. So I think those challenges bring people together. So that's also a very important element of community. And definitely, I think the administrative unit, how funds are allocated, you know, there is a politics to it. There is a money to it as well. You know, there are certain communities who need more support, and there are other communities who get more support. So there is also that strand that's animating this concept.
Fascinating. Sounds like politics to me, yeah?
Well, that's what you want to think. But there is also, like, a kind of, like, I think there are different layers to it, you know? People sometimes use it so emotionally. Yeah. And I absolutely understand. I'll give you an example of what I mean. For instance, if there is a, you know, it's quite a common occurrence here. Within the youth of specific boroughs, knife crime can range in different extremities. And if you lose a particular teenager, for instance, then there is an event, a phenomena where everybody comes and give flowers in a specific area or the person who's not there anymore. It's happened maybe a couple of months ago as well, years when somebody was raped, whatever, like if somebody's lost their life and all of that. So I think people also see it in that kind of really emotional way, you know? And then they write speeches and, you know, papers that Claire was a lovely girl and she was a very important part of the community. Their speeches, you know, communities come together and then build all these speeches. So I think people use it in a very emotional way also, right? I think that emotion also animates the way politics gets shaped up. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like then the MP of that borough is going to take note of, okay, this has happened. This is a major event. This needs to be brought into light. We need more visibility around it.
Got it. When you said that, you know, money is not a driver for you, which is interesting because, you know, many people in the pod have said that. But you said, like,
Have they said that? They have.
10 years later, I think some people will say that money is not a driver. I think some people, a lot of people say it's still important, but maybe not their primary driver. What do you mean by community is what you care about? Like, you've mentioned all, like, the definition of community. How does it become a driver, motivator for you? How do you see that? Like, what does success look like? How do you know you're moving forward on that, you know, I don't know, that important thing for you?
I think that's very interesting, you know. I mean, I have been thinking about this for a while now, and I think this podcast is definitely going to push me to articulate it in a more sort of structured and coherent way. So let me give you an example. For instance, maybe I'll sort of give you anecdotes to illustrate what I mean, if that helps. I've worked with basically generally third-party providers that work, give IT services to councils. So it could be anything like AirTech, it could be carbon management tools. And I primarily work with councils. So there are like B2B clients also, but I'm the one who looks at like council programs. And what I mean is that if there's a particular, say, Westminster Council, and they have a carbon management program, they have, like, for instance, 50 different SMEs under them, and they need all these SMEs to measure their carbon emission to see like how the borough is doing, how that particular area is doing, so that they can then like kind of see how UK can reach their net zero, right? So on a macro level, that's what I do, and how that animates my idea of success, my idea of fulfillment, my idea of happiness. Now I'll bring it back, like, so that's one element. Now the second element is that, you know, like it's getting a bit philosophical, but you know, at 32, for instance, if I would have had children, I think we all kind of care about things like, I don't know, we've started probably thinking about things like, I don't know, legacy and blah, 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 like purpose and all of that. And I see some of my friends having kids and then they have all these families and then they're sort of like, you know, saying, oh, now I don't live for myself, I live for my child, and all of these really maternal things. So what happens, and I'm sure many of us will start feeling like that as we grow older, at least when we hit 40, 45, what are we living for? So I think then I start thinking like, how can I, like, there are so many, like, you know, like, how can I build a, I mean, I don't know. I think the word legacy is so self elevating. It's such a big word, but I mean it in a very generic sense. I think we just want to matter when we're, you know, towards the end, that we've sort of contributed something. We've sort of, you know, just made sure the machine is well oiled and it's moving forward. My CEO said something very interesting, actually. She's around 64, and she said, and she doesn't need to really care about climate, you know. A lot of people, like, don't care about climate because they feel like they don't need to at that stage. Like, you know, we've lived our life, our pensions are sorted, everything's done, great. So I think there is a generational divide as well about people who are climate skeptics, denialists, and then, you know, so on. But she said something really nice. And she said that, I understand many of the people in my generation, we do have climate guilt. So there is a sort of you know, there are people who are suffering from that guilt, that, oh, we've done so much to the climate and our kids and our grandkids are not going to have a better world to live in. And I feel those sentiments, those emotions, do influence me as well. I just want to make sure, like, you know, we have a good, like, sort of everyone's living well, because somewhere, like, macroeconomically as well, Ruben, getting into the economics of it, like, it does affect everyone. So I think that's my sense of, like, you know, when I say community, I just feel like, you know, at the team level, there are like people who look up to me, or maybe who are like, you know, teaching me things, I'm teaching them things. So there is a bit of that belongingness there as well. Then there is, you know, within the neighborhood, many of us take volunteering roles, you know, so somewhere like there is a belongingness there. It is selfish in a way, it's self-referencing. You want to belong, but at the same time, you also want to make sure that the system is well oiled, so that your niece, your nephews, your friends, your blah, 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 all the people you can't see, they're going to live a good life. But it's mostly selfish, I think. I'm not so naive to think that it's like all about... No. I think it's mostly selfish. I think it's mostly like, you know, you want to matter, even though it's in a philosophical, you know, it's not my bank balance, but somewhere like I want to feel good when I'm dying in a hospital bed. I want to feel like I've done something useful.
I mean, I think you articulated pretty well. I can say that at least I share that sentiment. I'm sure a lot of people share that sentiment.
I hope it's not coming out as pretentious, and that's the reason I'm struggling to say it.
It's,
you know,
I
feel
hard.
Like we all, like, I don't want to undermine, like you've just said, like, you know, we've just discussed about visas and business and so on and so forth. I think we all care about money. We have to, especially like if you're living in different lands, away from families, away from support systems and all of that. I think we have to care about money, time, resource, your physical health, and all of that's really vital. But I think somewhere, I think, you know, that kind of really matters to me as well. And also another thing I want to, like, because I mentioned a very morbid reference of dying in hospital beds. You know, a couple of years back when we had the pandemic, and I remember, I think it was my aunt or maybe my mother, she got the virus and she was in a hospital, obviously. And she shared the story the night somebody, a gentleman, passed away. And he was absolutely, you know, by himself, because his family couldn't come and see him. And, you know, it was an ICU. And it was such a tragic story. This was, you know, those days when we had gas cylinder problems and all of that shit in, you know, Delhi. And that, just that little anecdote, you know, because my mother was there. So I felt, I thought about it and I'm like, oh my God, this is like really heavy. Imagine how somebody might be feeling when you really like are in that kind of naked situation where everything is stripped off you. And then how do you like sort of process that, that last few moments? So, yeah, I think, you know, in my spare time, I do think about this. I think that is kind of like the underlining current always.
You know. Fascinating. I will say it's not absolutely alien. I can tell you at least I think about it. I think legacy is a heavy word. You're right.
It is a heavy word. I know.
And maybe that doesn't sort of describe it in the best way. I don't use the word legacy, but as an example, I was telling somebody, I think on my previous podcast, among all the work I do, I think this podcast is, I wouldn't call it my legacy for sure. I think, yeah, like you said, it's a heavy word, but on my deathbed, I'd be quite proud of this. And what's interesting is that this will, you know, assuming that Spotify doesn't take it off the internet, this podcast will probably survive long after I have. And my voice, you know, people can listen to this for theoretically, you know, 1,000 years from now. So I know, I think I do understand the feeling. I think a lot of people do think about it. But yeah, I think you're right. It's very hard to articulate, very hard to like put a finger to
and I definitely think it's a bit selfish, because here again I want to footnote all of this highfalutin philosophical shit that I said, that it is selfish because, you know, if the more kind of conventionally all by yourself you are, the more you start thinking about it. Like if you have like a small group of like, you know, your kids or your family or your love, you know, your lover or your wife who really loves you, then you don't like, you're in this kind of you know. So I think it's also about self-validation. And I agree to that, totally.
Interesting. Okay, so before we go on any further, let me maybe, for people who are not fully up to speed on what Priyanka has been up to over the last decade, let me do a quick rundown. So Priyanka and I met at Stephens back in 2010. We were in the same class. We studied at Stephens we all joined in 2010. You graduated in 2013, then went on to D School, where you studied sociology for 2 years. You then moved to London. This was probably around 2016, to LSE to study anthropology. You spent another 2 years there. I want to talk a little bit about your time there, because in your voice note, which you shared, you said that was sort of like an inflection point on how you view the world. We'll talk a little bit about that one. Post LSE, you went to work at a bunch of different startups and early stage companies. Over the years, you were, of course, you know, most of them were based and operating in London. And today, you're at, as you said, you spend most of your time helping SMEs and public authorities control their carbon emissions at Climate Essentials.
Well, so helping, I mean, it is, you know, so, helping, you know, like, you know, it is business, so well, like.
Yeah, it's okay. They pay you money for it and you help them do it. Yeah, so, yeah, same. So, yeah, that in a nutshell is what Priyanka has been doing, has been up to over the last decade. As we go back to 2010, 2013, when we were in college, what's your favorite memory from your time at Stephens?
I just think I had such a good time in college. You know, I have such fond memories. In fact, I'd still go to college. Every time I go back to India, I still go to college.
Mm-hmm.
So what are my good memories?
One which comes to mind.
I think I just generally like had such a good time, but definitely Anurag Malhotra's classes were definitely, it's like a strange kind of existential angst. Because on some level, we are like backbenchers. So me, Ruben, Gaurav, we all are like backbenchers. So we're chilling. But on the other hand, we know we are so behind the syllabus. My God. So it was sort of existential angst. And then after the class, we just shake our heads and go to the science, sorry, the dhaba, and then get samosas and forget about it.
Man, those
classes. I think those were definitely good memories, and you know, Kamla Nagar and just the generic things. But what I really enjoyed about Stephens was that I know everybody works so hard. I know it. Mm. And everybody was super ambitious. But at least most of the people I met, including you, Ruben, everyone was so chilled.
Mm.
You just, I think people just made it look like it's a breeze. Like it's going to be fine. Like, you know, even if you're in a gutter, we'll like just pick ourselves up and get on with life. So I like that get on with life attitude, I think.
I'm glad to hear that college was a good experience for you.
Oh, it was such a lovely experience. I've had such a good time.
I was so surprised, and through this podcast, you know, a lot of people shared that it actually wasn't a very fun experience for many people. So whenever I ask that question, I'm always like, oh, like...
I had such a ball. Like, I still had, like, you know, I think I met, I had such a ball. And of course, there are some people like, you know, I'm sorry if you're listening to this, but... There are some people who are like, you know, they were really like working hard, and which was really nice because everyone was working hard. But the charm of the situation is that some people can just like be relaxed and chilled out while working hard.
Yeah.
And that's what I enjoyed so much about college.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Yeah. Anurag Malhotra's class was, I have to give it to the man. He came, his level of dedication to come up to class, you know, write all those questions and solutions on the board every single day, day in and day out. Oh my God. Hats off to the man. But okay, so that was Stephens. You went on to do school to study sociology and then LSC to do anthropology. I know when we were in college, a lot of people would use this lingo, but to be honest, I never understood the difference. Can you explain to me what is sociology, what is anthropology, and how are they different? And explain this to me as though I was a five-year-old.
You know, to be very honest, Ruben, what we do in DSC is actually, like in England, it would be called social anthropology. So it is anthropology, like because it's not quantitative at all. Okay. So the DSC sociology course is not quantitative at all. So the research methods, we do a paper research methods, and it's not quant.
Okay. And what is sociology then?
I think anthropology and sociology, mostly at least for me, I mean, if it was just one word I would use, is the focus of study. So anthropology would focus on the human being, on the individual, and the sort of relations he or she has. So it would kind of study the term called culture. You know, culture is the way the individual sort of relates to other individuals around them and how they kind of interact. It could be kinship. Kinship is, you know, familial relations. It could be symbols. What do different symbols mean? And it's very much centered towards this word called culture. And sociology, on the other hand, is the object of study is a society. And it's kind of more, you know, more like when you, it's the object of society, you know, study is more society and system. So it gets more quantitative. But culture is more about, say, for instance, values, symbols, the relations one has with each other, kinship ties. So, yeah.
Got it.
And you know, sociology would be mostly, it's almost a bit like what we did in public economics, for instance, but not, I mean, that's just one part of it. You study systems, you study, you know, people's behaviors and the incentive structures around it.
Got it.
But yeah, but anthropology is a bit more, like a lot more qualitative, and it studies a lot of the intangible aspects, like for instance, symbols, rituals, kinship, blah, 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 yeah.
And given that you studied both, like...
No, I mean, I didn't, you know, frankly, it's like I said, it's termed as sociology, but the DSC course is not sociology.
Okay.
It is anthropology.
Hmm.
And we'll get to that why. Like, because the sociology course that is in LSE is very, very different from how it is seen in DSE.
I see.
It's actually quite quantitative. So the minute, like, maths gets into the picture, it changes even the slant of the subject, because anthropology has quite a tense relation with numbers. There is a word called positivism. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of philosophical school of, you know, thought, mm-hmm. which basically says that when you start, you know, like, which basically says that you cannot like measure things as it is. Like there are different ways of mapping concepts, and you can't like quantify everything. And then, you know, you can't make like such a huge subject object.
Yeah.
It's going to get in like, you know, like a bit highfalutin, but in very simple terms, what positivism would mean is that like you can't dissect the subject and the object in clear cut terms. This is going to get into a whole like sort of situation, but let's just, you know, for the sake of simplicity, let's say that anthropology absolutely has very little to do with mathematics.
Okay.
And it, in fact, and it's not just because of practical reasons, but even like because of philosophical reasons, they don't use like quantitative reasoning as a research method.
Got it.
And sociology would definitely use it. And it's adopted. That's the reason sociological methods are adopted in all different systems, like even public policy, behavioral economics. So a lot of like economists actually go on to study sociology and so on and so forth. But anthropology has a bit of a tense relation that way.
I see.
And yeah.
And now that you've studied anthropology and, you know, you've been in like the workforce for a few years, like, is there, like, what is the point of studying anthropology? Like, what is the value of studying that? Or if somebody's considering, oh, I'm here, I'm thinking, I've just finished with an undergrad in economics or whatever degree, I'm considering anthropology. Like, why should one study anthropology?
Frankly, Ruben, you know, if I were to answer this question just for myself, like for what's the point of me studying it? Frankly, nothing. Like I am not using anthropology at all. I am not, I think naturally I'm not inclined to thinking like an anthropologist. I think somewhere I'm still a kind of systems kind of person. And I do like data to some extent to understand things, data in the sense like quantitative data. And personally, I think for me, I didn't use it very much. However, the two aspects it helped me was one, to just have a different lens of understanding myself. Because anthropology, like if you just take an ethnography and read it from start to finish, you will appreciate what I'm trying to say. Like, and especially the classroom experience is so different. Especially like the way things are delivered in the classroom or in the tutorial. Like Marcel Mauss's The Gift, for instance, a very like popular book. It's that thin. And you can read it like it would seem like a lot of jargon. But if you hear a teacher explain it to, I think the classroom experience is such a huge part of cultivating that anthropological sensibility. So I think definitely helped me understand myself, I think, a bit differently. I wasn't just thinking of myself as a cog in a wheel. So yeah, that's one. Second is, you know, the most important thing, it introduced me to this space called STS, which is Science Technology Society. A bunch of philosophers / anthropologists who are working specifically in laboratories and science-y related spaces, STEM-related spaces, less industries but more laboratories. And they are adopting almost an ethnography-style approach to understanding how is quote-unquote science made. And their premise is that science is made and it's not like a fact out there that emerges. And I know to a lot of listeners, this might seem quite alien. So you have to get into maybe a little bit of that literature to understand it. But that idea was quite novel. And I didn't buy into it, obviously. But how like facts and figures are sort of made, and there's a whole culture around science and tech. So I think it introduced me to that bunch of literature, which got me thinking, which got me sort of like looking into different spaces. And that's what brought me into the early stage tech world. I mean, I'm sure I would have like come to it anyway. But I mean, long story short, it's easy to be absorbed into the workforce if you work for, you know, startups, because you're wearing so many hats. So it's not like a specific skill set you need. And I didn't have an MBA or anything, but I could get the job work done. But it also helped me appreciate what I'm doing in a different way. I never felt bad, like I'm not working for a Deutsch or a Deloitte. I wish I was there. So I really like enjoyed working in that space.
You mentioned in your voice note that your time at LSE when you were studying anthropology, sort of led to you creating a different way at looking at the world. You mentioned that there was like a point of inflection. Do you remember what that point of inflection is, or like how?
Yes, I mean,
changed?
You know. Well, I mean, creating a different way. I don't think I have created any different way. I don't even think I have one way of doing things that I can preach to others. So I think that if I've said that, I'll take that back. But it definitely helped me look at the world in a different way. That's true. And this is what I meant. I think the word culture, I just, the person I was and the person that got into economics, I never took culture seriously. Like, I think till date, like, I'm the last person who'll wear, like, a sari because it's culturally appropriate. Like, it just doesn't make logical sense to me. I'm very functional. I think that's the person I have been. And till date, I think that way. I can't see the value in culture. And I know a lot of people live culture, quote unquote, because it's convenient. Like, you go to a shadi, so you wear a sari. And then, you know, you go to mandir, so you bow your head or whatever. But I really wanted to, it made me understand like why culture exists and why it is practical to have culture, and that culture can translate into even cultures in the laboratory, for instance, like how processes are done in a specific way, why the collection team is different from the, you know, the team that works in the laboratory or the team that, you know, takes those samples and makes something else out of it. So it just made me like really take culture seriously. And I know for a lot of listeners, culture might be quite a generic term, and that's how we see culture. But for an anthropology student, culture is quite a loaded term. So we have like piles and piles of books on culture, like just that word and what it means. So it really like made me understand like, wow, this is not just like some wearing a sari or bowing your head in front of an idol or something. So, yeah.
I know we probably will not get into be able to cover it all, but like, what is culture then? If somebody hasn't studied anthropology, like, what is culture? I know in startups and companies, we talk about, oh, this company has a good culture, this has a bad culture, toxic culture.
You know, Ruben, not to put you in a spot, but because culture is such a generic term, and you've rightly said we use it all the time in management, you know, systems now. What do you think of culture? Like, because I will come with a kind of, you know, because I'm indoctrinated into this anthropology, so I'll come with a very, like, complex understanding. So I just wanted to know, like, what do you think of when you hear that word?
I think, so my lens on culture is two things. Number one is just, like you said, you know, saris, I bow my head, like, more, like, traditional way of, you know, like, almost like an operating system of a society, of a group of people. But then it's also, you know, the other experience I have with the word culture is at companies, especially like, you know, early stage, mid stage companies, wherein it, you know, there's a certain culture. So I think my understanding of culture is it's I think like a set of behavior, which is, you know, accepted in that group of people, wherein as long as you do that, like that is what is expected in that group of people. And ideally it should be somehow like linked to where that group, what the objective of that group of people is. So as an example, you know, in a company and a startup, we have a culture of, you know, bias for action as an example. That's part of our culture. We will always, you know, we will spend less time discussing, more time doing. That is part of our culture. If you do that, you know, people in that group of people, you know, I won't say praise you, or it's acceptable that you're doing the right thing. You know, you're contributing positively to that society or that group of people. And it is valuable because it helps us move faster towards our goal of, I don't know, say building this company or trying to solve the problem the company's trying to solve. So that's my understanding of culture. There's just maybe a set of actions or like set of like social norms maybe, which everybody agrees on. And they are kind of things which help that group of people move forward towards whatever goal they're trying to achieve. Yeah, that's my definition.
Yeah, I think it is actually quite aligned to several of the theorists that we've read. I mean, my understanding is that, I mean, from my, like, also be, like, from my understanding within anthropology and in life in general, there is a structure to things. And you've rightly said, like, say in a family or in a community or in a company or whatever, the way, like, things relate to each other, in a way, I like your word operational system. I really see it as an operational system. And there are certain norms and behaviors that make sure that machine is well-oiled and it's moving forward and everyone's kind of happy. They are motivated to do the right thing and the whole sort of. So I definitely see it as from that lens of an operating system. However, where I find things a bit interesting as maybe a, not as an anthropologist, even as a human being, is change. So what, like, if a company culture has to change because it's in a different stage of their growth, like, for instance, once you hit your first, you know, big seed funding, whatever, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, then you need to scale certain processes. You need to get different kind of people into this, into the team. Initially, maybe you're just hiring grads and then you kind of get in touch with recruitment agencies to hire different people. Then definitely you'll have somebody who talks money in a very different way. And the grad, you know, communications executive might feel a bit like, oh my God, what's... So then culture then starts shifting. And how much of that change is okay? How much of the change is not okay? What rocks the boat too much? So I think those change is what I find personally quite interesting.
Yeah,
like from that operating system point of view.
I see. So in society,
are you able to, like, you know, I hope you're following, like, you know, I'm giving you examples of, like, startups so that you can, like, it doesn't get too
absolutely. Scary. Absolutely. I think it does make, I think the example of change is a very good one because my experiences of culture is only at startups. And I think I've had the chance to work at startups at different stages. And I've seen companies, you know, when they're 100 people and when they're 900 people, I don't think people fully understand it the way you articulated it, but yes, you know, things work when we're 100, things stop working when we're 900, and nobody really knows why and what happened, right? But the system just stops working. Like, smart people, well-intentioned people, you know, enough resources, but something goes wrong or something happens along that way and it just stops functioning, right? That's the time you call in people to define culture, define vision, mission, all of that stuff. But yeah, if you extrapolate to the nth degree, I'm sure, like, you know, societies and communities and, you know, boroughs and countries all have to function. You know, things change, the world changes, and you got to change. And I guess that's the element of culture, which, yeah, I never thought about. But yeah, I see why it is.
These are, like, you know, these are practical examples I've seen. Like, the minute, like, all the hiring managers will say, we want to ensure the new hire is very much aligned with the culture, but I'm like, hold on, you are scaling.
Yeah.
So what are you saying? Like, you know, because the culture that you have right now, it's 80% of grads, for instance. So they barely have work experience elsewhere. They don't have organizational experience. So of course the culture is going to change.
Yeah.
Right. So it's for you to kind of really understand how much of that change you want.
Mm.
And then the incentive structures are so different, right? In that moment of change, because if you're a grad who's fresh out of university, you'd probably just be wanting your next cushy job. But then if you're, like, a mid-range manager, then you'd probably want something else. And the conversations after probation might be very different. Like, you'd need 25% increment, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, I think all of that then,
Fascinating. That was a good little tangent on culture. Yeah, I can imagine this being an entire two-year course or, like, a PhD to just deep dive into... Yeah, culture and just so many different, like, walks of life. But anyway, we shall park that one if you're not into culture or anthropology, maybe. But if you are, well, you should absolutely hit up Priyanka. I'm sure she has much more to share. Okay, you so far, I think, so far, so good. You then decided to work at startups. I know you mentioned that through your time at LSE, when you were going through it, there was an inflection. You were excited about, or at least that motivated you to work in the world of startups. before we get into the stuff you were doing, if not for startups, so going into LSE, what was the plan? Like you would get this degree in anthropology. What were you planning to do after that? Like get a PhD, stay in academia?
Yeah, totally, Ruben. You know, I come like, yeah. So I think I had quite that route in mind, get a PhD. Probably like, I probably won't, like realistically, I won't hit like an Ivy or anything. Mm-hmm. So just go wherever I get decent amount of money and I like my supervisor, possibly mm-hmm. across the pond, because mm-hmm. the UK was quite, like we don't have a lot of funding for overseas students, at least back then. So, okay. So yeah, that was really the plan, to get into a PhD program, hopefully, and then hopefully get into teaching eventually. And teaching, like I have been very realistic from the start. So I didn't have any kind of aims of wanting to work outside. I was very happy getting a nice PhD, enjoying my PhD program, having a good time, and then going back to India and then teaching.
Hmm. And clearly that is not the plan, or that hasn't happened.
Well, I mean, you know, if I say things, you know, it's going to sound so pretentious. I'm sure a lot of people are scoffing like, oh my God, what does she think she's saying?
No.
It's true. Like, it's really true. I think some of my friends like from Stevens would know it.
But is that still the plan? Do you still want to go get a PhD and go back to teaching and then eventually move back?
No, not teaching anymore for sure. I mean, definitely it'd be nice to, you know, do some kind of teaching capacity if I'm qualified. Definitely. Mm. It's a different skill set as well. That doesn't just require hard skills, but also your soft skills. Yeah. But I don't want to undermine teaching. But no, not at all. Like, hopefully, like, I would like to get some more classroom qualification, maybe like a business degree. I don't know what. But yeah, not like that straight list. I think things have changed now because I've worked quite for a while and I enjoy it. So, yeah.
Got it. Okay. So after LSE, you went to work at a bunch of different startups, a lot of early stage. I'm very curious to know, what do you enjoy? Like, what do you like about working at early stage? You've worked at a few now, but what sort of excites you? I know startups are a very exciting place. They mean different things to different people. What excites you about
everything? Everything. No, I mean, I think everything about, you know, when I started to work at VIDA, I think everything about it excited me. Like, I remember I barely, like, so for just for the listeners, I had zero work experience. I had zero skills. No MBA, no nothing. So I was given what? Like, I was given a couple of spreadsheets, a couple of software. You know, we had, you know, it was a beta stage. We were testing a software. And I just had to make sure, like, all of the users there, I have to log in their feedback and then run it through the IT team, the developers team. So I just enjoyed it so much. That interface mm-hmm. between different, they were the users, the commercial team, and then the IT team. I really got a bit of a kick that I could understand all three languages. Like, when I mean all three languages, I could switch codes. I could speak to the users who were like 75-year-old people using the tech. So they had very different set of needs. Some of them were going through end-of-life crisis. Some of them were going through different sort of mental health issues. So that was a different audience. The commercial team obviously cared about different things. So they cared about how many users and then, you know, which package are we hitting? Which is this the right package? Does the council want to buy this package? Blah, blah, blah. Different kind of conversations. And then the IT team, so I used to do sprints with them like every other week. So I used to sit in those meetings. So I really enjoyed all of it. Just the interface, like how all of them were so different and I could be an insider instantly.
Interesting. And maybe the right question I should have asked you is what did you like the least working at early stage startups? Because it's not all fun and games.
People who are slow. So I'm sure everyone you would know. So here I don't mean mentally.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, like, I think the nature of startups is it has to go quite fast because, you know, we don't have money that much. That's not like a pot of money you're sitting on for years and years and, you know, you can do whatever you want. So it is, you know, I think the burnout rate needs, it can be really high, but the thing is you have to ensure it all generates some kind of momentum.
Mm.
And if there are people who are not well aligned, they don't know why they're here, they don't have that speed and that agility, especially kind of office politics and all of that. And now we have a nice word called communications problems. Mm. So I think those things really piss me off. But apart
from
that,
did you experience a lot of that? Did you experience a lot of that in your companies?
Lots. Because, you know, like, because hiring, you know, you don't have a 100% hold of hiring, no?
Correct.
So you have to, like, hire people in different stages of their career. They want different things out of this. You know, sometimes, like, they, you know, they might go out after 1 year or then they might stay for 2 years. So I think, like, you know, you don't get, like, quote unquote, different people have different incentives. That's what I'm saying. And hiring, like, you don't have a lot of money. So you can't be very picky about who the people you're choosing. Sometimes we barely even have money to go to a recruitment agency. A lot, lots of hirings happen in-house by people who are managing operations. So definitely, I think, you know, I mean, frankly, I think, you know, hiring in-house is also very good rather than getting a recruitment agency to hire. So, yeah, I think the, you know, quote unquote, nice word. These days we have a safe word now, communications problem.
Well, what's the unsafe word?
Sorry.
What is the unsafe
word? Word is politics, isn't it? Politics and getting too emotional and blah, blah, blah.
I see. Got it.
No, not politics. I think politics is a bit of a loaded word. But, you know, if somebody is like,
drama.
You know, somebody's not. Yeah, like drama and, you know, like somebody's not understanding. There are lots of people who need training as well.
Yeah,
you know, there are lots of people who need like a lot of training. They like ask the same question 5, 6, 7, 8 times.
They're just slow.
You're spending like the whole 2 days trying to sort out a testimonial that has to go live on IG.
Oh my god, I know the feeling. Did any of the companies you worked at shut down?
Not officially. I think one got merged with a larger consultancy. The other one is still like fully functioning. In fact, they have their 5-year anniversary in the House of Lords where they have invited their past employees.
Wow. So then what made you leave? Like you've worked at a few companies ever since.
What
I know at early stage, you join a company with, you know, you bought into the vision. In a lot of cases, they give you some stock. They incentivize early employees to stay on for a long
time. So I think the stock options, you know, if you're talking all the stocks and all of that, well, I mean, we do, all of us, you know, we're not like, it wasn't such a clear cut with stock options. Not everybody got a stock option. Some of the contract laws didn't even have stock options, many of them. So it works a bit differently. Some companies do, some companies don't. I mean, you know, mostly the incentive structures were a bit like, I didn't leave companies for money or for benefits, to be very honest. I think here's the way I looked at it. So I treated every work as a project rather than like as a full-time kind of you know, commitment. I wasn't in the senior team. It wasn't my company.
Yeah,
you know, I was quite young. So maybe look at it, you can look at it from my perspective. I wanted to learn operations. So then I learned operation. I worked for 9 months, 1 year, whatever. And then I learned that bit and then I moved out to something else. So I think the first 2 years, that's exactly what I did. I just wanted to learn those skills, work really hard, get to know interesting people, build my network. So that's what I did. And, you know, that worked really well because we treated each engagement of mine as a project. So Priyanka set up these, you know, beta list. She tested them. So now we have, you know, this list. They're fully functioning. Yeah. The technology can scale. So I think they brought in obviously a more experienced person back then because I probably wouldn't have been super experienced to get that.
Correct.
So that's one. That's my own personal reason. And I think with one or two of the companies, it was also financially difficult to help us get promotions or, you know, to get pay rises. And then after working for a couple of months, you definitely would want something more.
Got it. You know. Got it. And you're now at Climate Essentials. Would you call it a startup or is it like a more larger sized company?
It is growing and it is well incubated like like it's well cushioned. It's a sister company of another larger company.
Mm-hmm.
So it's well kind of sandwiched and cushioned and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's growing. It's growing. It's got a very great management board. And it's not a standalone founder who's doing it.
Got
so
it.
The bunch of people who are behind it. So,
mm.
yeah. But yes, answering your question, it is a growth stage startup. Yeah.
Got it. Understood. Yeah, I found it quite fascinating, the kind of stuff you were doing. So if you look at Priyanka's work, it's a very niche, I think, in my opinion, in my world, a very niche
really?
Field.
Really? You think so?
You are essentially selling, or the various companies you worked at, you're selling different kinds of software to government or quasi-government organizations to help them with certain of their goals. So Climate Essentials, for example, you're helping SMEs and public authorities take control of their carbon emissions. So what you're doing is you're selling them software, just like any other company, any other SaaS company or enterprise SaaS company, but you're selling to government, you know, organizations for certain objectives that they need to meet. I think when you were at Vida, it was more around healthcare data. And now with Climate Essentials, more around carbon. I personally spend a lot of time in enterprise sales in my current job. I'm curious to know, selling to government just seems very like hard or very long. What have you learned about, you know, just engaging or delivering these kind of projects with government?
When you say hard or long, do you mean like, you know, it's like, do you have that image where somebody is, as a salesperson, going knocking on council doors?
Yeah, like I just have the image when you go, you meet them, nothing happens for like 5 years. And then in the sixth year, you're like, oh my God, they signed the contract. There's a big ceremony. You sign some, you know, MOUs. And then another 5 years, by the time they actually start using your software. Is it like that? Or is it different?
Well, I think there might be a lot of arrangements, Ruben. So here I'm not going to, like, please don't take my statement as all the different ways in which private, public, or whatever,
yeah,
startup, public,
so just,
you know.
Your point.
But in my experience, there are two things to it. One is that we compete for tenders.
Mm.
So bid writing is a huge part of my experience. So we write bids. We do tenders. We ensure, like, you know, everything else that comes with writing tenders, like the cost and blah, 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 blah. So all of that, that's how we get some of our contracts. That's one. And tender is, even though it's a black and white process, but as you know, everything in life is not only black and white.
Yeah.
So there's a relationship building element to it as well. So it helps if you know somebody from the council, if you've done good work, if there are quasi-council networks, as you rightly said, know about you, if you've, you know, if you basically manage to embed yourself.
Yeah.
So it definitely helps. But it is an application process. You write tenders and you get that contract. That's one. Second is that you also have a lot of grants. So a lot of our organizations, especially, for instance, What Impact, which was the previous organization I worked with for, they were funded by Innovate UK. And Innovate UK is a government grant. And because it's a government grant, it is obviously a gateway to, you know, like working with the public sector. And how they do it is that mostly through pilots. So you can do like a pilot. And I think the word we are missing here is innovation. And here I know like innovation is thrown around a lot, but a lot of these solutions that we are doing, Ruben, the look on your face, you feel like
innovation and government is like throw around is like an understatement. Like everybody is doing innovation and digitization and
everybody's doing that.
But to be honest, I think in their defense, like when you look at how systems operate, yes, there is a lot of like lot to be desired. So yeah, I think, yes, like I can see why digitization is such a big word for them, because it actually is, you know, stuff. It's crazy how much stuff still happens on pen and paper. But yeah, I think when you work in tech, you're just like, what do you mean by digitization? Like everything is digital, right? But that, I think, is a bubble in itself. Everything is not very digitized.
But here, I want to embed the word innovate, because I'll give a practical reason. If you want to be selected, quote unquote, by a government department, then obviously they're not going to select you if your service is, you know, they can get it for a cheaper rate somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
So it's definitely something innovative that you are doing. And here, innovation doesn't mean like some highfalutin virtual reality shit. It also means you help the government save cost.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, do it more efficiently. So that is how we got some of our pilots, actually. We just pitched our ideas, and then through a grant or through an introduction, the government felt like, all right, this technology might just make our process efficient. Yeah. So either through tenders or through grants or through some sort of innovation conversations.
Yeah.
But it is all like a need. I think no government departments are going to give a piece of work to a IT provider because they like them. They'll do it because the budget is like different.
Correct. So coming to my next question, which I'm curious about, is you're currently, helping these organizations take control of carbon emissions. I know there's a big mandate from the governments. Since you all sell the software, if there was no government mandate to do this carbon emission monitoring or become carbon neutral, like, why should SMEs care? Like, is there an argument on
this
why?
This is actually, you are literally hitting, the bird's eye. There is no mandate, Ruben, in the UK. There is no mandate, to be honest. I mean, I'm sure the EU has a different set of regulations, but within the UK, for SMEs, and this is probably for if anybody's interested listening to it, there is no mandate for SMEs. It's not compulsory for SMEs to report on their carbon emissions. Mm. It is only compulsory for certain bigger organizations, and there is a headcount to it.
Yeah.
To report on their carbon emissions, and that too not holistically end to end. There's just chunks that they have to report, like banks, for instance, big corporations like Tesco, Lidl, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's one. Second is that you're absolutely right. There is hence no incentive then for SMEs.
Mm.
And that is why my life is so beautiful, because you have to find all fictions.
No, but I'm sure you guys believe. I'm sure you guys see that. Otherwise, how can you sell it, right? How can you sell it?
Absolutely. It's like... Absolutely. I mean, when I say my life is very beautiful, one is that... I think one is that the council programs really help, because, that is really a safe spot, to be honest. I think the B2B team is having a harder time. Because when you're selling it to a business, then you're really selling it to them and you're asking them for money.
Yeah.
But for the councils, what happens that they all the licenses are free for the SMEs. And you'll be interested to know, it's quite interesting that despite all the licenses being free, the uptake can still not be super enthusiastic. Because like you rightly said, Ruben, it's not just money that the SMEs have to put away. It's also time. Yes. They might have to hire somebody to do this. They might have to hire somebody, to report all of that, get all that data, and then blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Fascinating.
We have to create incentive structures. You're spot on. I think the government, the private organizations have to create, the larger private organizations have to create incentive structures and make it easy for the SMEs to report. And now, it's kind of sad. I have a lot of sympathy for the SMEs because... we have a big supermarket branch called Tesco in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard of it. And they have told to all their small suppliers, like somebody's making bread, somebody's making parathas or whatever it is, that you have to show your carbon reporting or footprint or whatever. Only then can we take your supplies. So now, even though it's not compulsory for that lady making parathas to report, but because of her supply chain, she has to. So in a way, it's really sad because, these guys, I barely think they are generating that much of carbon emissions. A lady making parathas in her kitchen or whatever.
Yeah.
But now she has to care about, CO2 equivalent tonnage of emissions and all of that. So,
I think when we started this conversation, you said something about your boss talking about, this guilt of culture, of climate and things like that. I know in Europe, it's a big theme, but since you work in now climate, how big of a problem is it really? Is it really a big problem of that we are at this, precipice wherein, oh my God, we're going to go back to the ice age or global, the seas are going to overflow. Because I know that I've heard people on both sides of the aisle, but some people will be like, oh my God, this is a big problem, or like, you know, it's the most ignored problem. But at the other end, like, there are people who say this is all one big fiction. How in your world and the people you interact with, how bad of a problem is like climate right now? And this whole carbon emission and things like that.
Ruben, there are all kinds of people. I understand the spectrum that you're talking about. There are climate denialists. There are climate skeptics. There are also, and this is where I think it's really inspiring, actually, you know, I am somebody who does believe the science. I'm not a denialist. There is IPCC and there is like greenhouse gas emissions and there are facts and figures.
Mm.
I've tried to familiarize myself. I absolutely agree. When I first came in, I wasn't ahead of the curve or anything. Mm. I didn't know so many things.
Mm.
And I tried to familiarize myself, read and talk to people, understand what the problem is, try and get a macro level sense of what's happening.
Mm.
And as a person from South Asia, I definitely feel like there is a disparity. And when I say disparity, like, the carbon that's emitted by countries like Europe or the UK or the US, who are way ahead of the curve when it comes to industrialization, was so much more, and most importantly, from so long. And now, like, the growth stage countries like India, where you barely have factories, so forget about carbon emission. People barely even have sometimes 3 meals a day. So how are you going to even think about vegan and all that bullshit? So... So I think there is a disparity, and that's what personally got me. That's my hook. And I'm not being sensational, or I'm not being like provocative when I say this. It's not West versus East, but I feel like as a globe, everybody has to come together and ensure we all, you know, maybe the global South cuts down on their emissions and helps the global North, the global North cuts down on their emissions and helps the global South transition and so on. So that's my hook. You know, that's where I find myself entering this conversation. And but answering your question, there are all kinds of people in the UK. And there are hardcore denialists as well. And I see them as clients. But also there are clients, not colleagues, friends, or, you know, there are all kinds of people. That's what I'm saying. But there are also like people who are extremely passionate. And this is where it's promising for me. I think being an Asian, I am a bit like, I don't take anything too seriously. Mm. Or even if I'm very enthusiastic, I'll just show like, you know, I'm very serious. And it's, but there are people who are so passionate about this, so extremely passionate. They want to induct like solar panels. They want to ensure that there is like wind. They'll get into, I don't know, some kind of crazy business plan to show that solar panels are more than. So they're so passionate. And these are like simple people from
towns. What do you think drives them? Like, I don't think people experience the problems of climate on a day-to-day basis. I think these are problems of the future. You don't like, you know, like most founders start a company or they will start something because they experience a problem. They feel the pain today. I don't think this is a bit naive, but I don't think the average person today experiences the problems of climate. What do you think drives these people who are so passionate about climate?
You're so spot on, right, you know, Ruben. This is exactly how I felt like 2017 when I started to think about climate change. And I remember I got a present as my wedding gift from one of my friends, Risha, if you're listening to this. So, and there was a chapter on it and there were like all these images of climate and, you know, like floods and all of that. And the whole idea of that book was to make climate change come and affect you. And that book, frankly, you know, didn't do it for me, even though I really enjoyed it. Rishabh, babe, I love you. But then, but the thing is, it didn't do it for me because it still felt very out there. It still felt so out there. And then I read this book, I feel, I'm forgetting, I can share it with you. But basically talks about technologies that the Western countries are investing in to capture carbon from seas and the climate, from the atmosphere.
Mm.
So there are some companies who are investing in technologies that basically capture carbon and puts it back in coral reefs, I think in Australia. And it showed how the marine ecosystem is getting affected because of it, because of that kind of crazy technology.
Hmm.
So I don't know, it sounds a bit sentimental, but just the way she had written that ethnography, like almost personifying, like bringing these fishes and these living beings to life, it made me feel sad. I just felt like sad, you know. I felt, yeah, I felt empathy. Like, you know, poor thing. Like, these guys are like, so in a way, like, I could understand. And then, you know, because she said it in a larger sense, so I could understand, like, this is real. Like, this is real in the sense, I don't know, like, the facts and figures and all of that. But what people are doing, you know, Ruben, like, you know, think about it. When you say what is real, I don't think nature as a system is doing all of this on its own. It's the things have happened to nature because of the actions around us. And I have seen the level of greed. I think I've experienced that even from a macro level. Like, companies will just not, like, I've had conversations, I've met people, they will not, like, stop doing many of the things that are explicitly polluting. And here I'm sounding a bit like an activist, but what I'm, the point I'm trying to drive home is that that level of greed and that level of aggression is there. And maybe coming from a, like, I don't know, a country, and now I don't want to romanticize India, but, like, there was this kind of saying when I was growing up, you just eat how much you need. Like, don't be like, you know, leave somebody for, you know, something for everyone. So that sentiment is, I think, getting faded. And because of all of these collective mindsets, this over hyper consumerist society, where people just want to, like sometimes I talk to the kids at, you know, in my neighborhood, and what's your next goal? Like, to go to the moon. I'm like, that's like, so like, we're talking about space tourism, which is great. But then there are also, like, you know, countries who are in war right now. So as a system, I think if you, like, let's go back to the operating system analogy. I know we've massively gone off a tangent, but I feel like people's actions and mindsets are definitely making the situation bad. And that's all adding to the facts and figures that you're talking about. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, I would say I watch Al Gore, and I think his movie a few years ago, and I was like, oh my God.
You have to just get out and do some volunteering work, Ruben, like some proper legit volunteering work to get in touch.
I mean, I live in Singapore, so there's not, I mean, there is a lot of volunteering.
I know.
Yeah, it's a great, like, the city functions pretty well. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I think you don't see a lot of the problems a lot of the world faces here. But anyway, that's a separate thing. Okay, I know we are almost at the hour. As you look back over the 10 years, Priyanka, have there been any big shifts in belief that you've had? And by shift in belief, I mean something you would believe very strongly, say in your early 20s or, you know, late teens, and you've taken like a 180 degree shift on that belief.
Oh God, I want to say something related to work and all of that, but I think this conversation has been just about startups. But I think, yes, I feel like there are so many things that have shifted or at least have evolved or changed radically. But one of my fundamental beliefs that have changed is, it sounds a bit cliche, but I think the idea of romantic love, it's changed quite a bit, the idea of companionship and, you know, like, and how that sort of determines. I think maybe because of the circumstances I've personally gone through my life, I think everything is a chapter and everything is, like, so significant. And I know these words get thrown around a lot, but I don't believe in, like, sort of one essential idea of love or friendship or kinship. I think there are disconnects which happen. People can get disconnected. I've accepted it. You know, you can lose people. You can get disconnected. You can completely feel differently about somebody after 10 years. And that's fine. I think that's fine because that doesn't mean that that chapter did not add value to your life. It's. I think, you know, Ruben, what I'm trying to say is that we should just get comfortable with the fact that people can completely disconnect. And I've accepted that. And not, like, resigned to that fact, but I've just seen this as a natural process of, like, going ahead in life.
I see.
I used to be quite, I think when I was younger, I was a bit naive and I would feel like I would be a little in denial and I would kind of hold on to it. and feel like I, you know, I don't want to succumb to that fact. But as I grow older, I just feel like it's fine. Disconnects happen all the time. People absolutely change and you don't feel the same with them. And that's all right. I think you should just be easy on yourself and them, and you should let it go with grace, because you had like a great, meaningful chapter that added to your journey.
Yeah. Do you fear that with this sort of belief or realization, you know, entering new relationships is a bit, or like entering new sort of, yeah, just relationships with people, like, does that change knowing that, oh, maybe this is also just a chapter to shut one day?
Now you've reduced it. Well, no, not really.
No.
You know? Not really. I think because some of the relations I've had, be it friendship or whatever, they have been constant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are talking after 10 years and it still doesn't feel quite any different. So I think, you know, there are relations which are constant, but the reason why is because of distance. Sometimes distance is also really important for two people or three people or five people who are living in the same house. You just have to have your distance. You have to have a little bit of detachment. You have to be able to come back and have that conversation with yourself. If you get too merged with each other, then I think I'm trying to say boundaries are important. And I don't believe that I will like meet people and then lose them and all of that. You know, I feel like if we establish the right boundaries and if we establish some common values, then we'll stay on. But you know, Ruben, like one thing is definitely true. Out of the 1,000 people you meet in life, there are just like maybe two or three, five at the most that you stick on. And who really like enjoy your company, you know, like who don't have to meet you because you're a manager or, you know, you're an investor or who just like call you and then, babe, let's go and get a drink. So, yeah, I mean, I think you have to check your expectations also, right?
No, knowing this, how do you feel? I agree. Like at the end of the day, there are maybe like just a handful of people who you want to, you know, build and maintain those relationships. I won't say maintain, but like invest into those relationships. Knowing that, like, has that changed in how you, like, do you like go out less? Do you just hang out with the same people? I feel for me, knowing sort of this, that there are only a handful of people eventually who, you know, quote unquote matter. Sometimes, you know, I don't know. I fear that, you just become a very boring person, that you're like, oh, I'm just going to stick this small little shell of mine and not going to sort of, you know, look beyond. I don't know. Do you feel that way?
I know, because I go out a lot, actually. Like, go out in the sense not to clubs and parties and things like that, but generally I put myself out there a lot.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that. I enjoy, like, you know, kind of meeting new people and all of that. And I absolutely agree. A lot of it gets filtered down the sieve.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you don't even like, you know, but I still enjoy the experience. I enjoy the encounter. I enjoy that conversation.
Knowing, you know, that you're unlike probably this person, you will never meet them and you don't care about it.
Yeah. You know, absolutely. Because I feel like, you know, the constants that I have in my life, which are, you know, touch wood, you know, organically built. I think they have my back. If I knock on their door and, you know, if I ask a favor, I feel like the very few people I have in my life, I think we have each other's back. So I don't feel like too insecure. And all of that's happened very organically. So, yeah. But you know, Ruben, I think, you know, yes, I mean, I have lost people, like, quote unquote, lost, disconnected. But it's not a big issue for me. Like, it's fine, you know, like, they are in a different growth stage. You know, they have evolved in a different way. I've evolved in my different way. As long as we can, like, be nice to each other, if we bump into each other and say nice things, it's fine.
Got it. Two pieces of advice you would have for 19-year-old Priyanka.
Oh, dear. There are so many, I think, I would say. You know?
The top two.
But I think one thing is that, you know, I'm very prone to anxiety and overthinking. I think I definitely, you know, sort of say generally till now, not even 19-year-old, 30 plus year old Priyanka. I think generally I'm a bit like prone to neuroticism. So I'll just like, you know, be more zen. Just you do you and then be more zen, I think. That's one. And second is, you know, definitely like I think prioritize work, to be very honest. Somehow, I mean, I have gotten to Stephens and then LSE and then whatever, like, you know. So clearly I'm not like stupid. But at the same time, like, I just never prioritized work so much because I just felt like, you know, oh, it's just one of the things that gets you money. It's not really important or it gets you status or whatever. But I feel like, especially in London, it's contributed so much to my well-being, like who I am, who my friends are, how people see me. Of course, the bills, it's paid the bills, but, you know, it just contributed so much to my well-being. So I definitely think that to the 19-year-old Priyanka, like, I've taken so much for granted. I got, like, a lot of opportunities in fair, like, we were in the right spaces, but then I took it for granted. I feel like, yeah, I've come to see the role that work can play in somebody's life. Like, beyond the money and all of that, yeah.
Got it. Awesome. Before we wrap up, after all the questions I've asked you, Priyanka, you get to ask me one question. What question do you have for me?
Well, how did you feel talking, having this conversation?
I enjoyed it. I like every single other episode. It's
Well, I mean, what are you going to say? I did enjoy. Come on. Like, you know, you got to give me a little bit more than that. I mean, and you have to be,
What answer are you expecting?
Well, because I can see your expressions, right? Like, you know, for the listeners, they can't see your expressions, but you're on camera all the time. So I am, body language is a form of communication. So I just want you to decode it in words for the listeners out there who can't see you.
Oh my God. I mean, you'll get it from my voice. Your question again, what did I think of this conversation?
How did you just feel about the conversation? Because I feel like, you know, it was quite like, there's so many touch points we have in common through Stephens and blah, blah, blah. And then I'm sure a lot of what I said also resonated with you dealing with like, you know, so how did you like kind of feel? Maybe not about me in particular, but generally about the conversation.
Okay, let me try and articulate this well. No, I really enjoyed it. I think there are a few things which, you know, I will take away from this conversation. I think the first one being, I'm actually quite like, maybe talk about this more offline, is I think the kind of stuff you spoke about, like culture and like the little conversation we had on anthropology, sociology, human systems, I think that's one thing I take away. I don't think I know too many people who've studied anthropology, sociology, but I do see, I think the world is sort of changing in very interesting ways. And the better you understand, you know, things like society, things like how people interact with each other, even this thing of, you know, culture just not being, you know, bowing and wearing a certain piece of clothing is, I think there is immense value to understand that really well. I think the easiest example I would give is, and in fact, when you sent me the voice note, I was thinking about it, is just the concept of money, right? For people who listen to this podcast will know, I am quite interested and fascinated with the world of cryptocurrency. And I think the philosophical debate or the philosophical, you know, argument for everything crypto is that we need to rethink money, and we need to rethink how, you know, financial systems work for us in the world. And that stems from the basic understanding on what is money, right? Like, what is money? Like, once you sort of fully understand what money is, then you can understand how it is going to change. And a lot of people don't understand what money is. And I think, you know, when you sort of go through that rigor of understanding, why do we have certain rituals? Why do we have, you know, why do we all accept this piece of paper? When did it start? What were we doing before accepting this piece of paper, right? It, I think, helps decode that question of, hey, what is money and what is it going to be in the future? So that's one big takeaway. Another thing I would take away from this conversation is, I think the stuff you mentioned about legacy and stuff like that, I think when we started, I think, you know, I was talking to somebody else and there's Maslow's pyramid of needs. And the first one, of course, I think most people who listen to this podcast maybe, you know, did not experience level one, where it is, you know, you just need safety, security, blah, blah. Most of us probably started level two, where it was like, you know, employment, money, roof on your head. And then there are three more layers, which I feel a lot of us are trying to figure out. But it's, again, just another need. The third one, I think, is around, you know, community, family, like having a sense of belongingness. The fourth level is around status, recognition, you know, self-worth. And the fifth one is like self-actualization, wherein, you know, quote unquote, be the best version of or reach your full potential, Allah. So I think there are, like, when you're probably around in your 30s, maybe call this midlife crisis, it was interesting to sort of hear you articulate like your version of that. For me, my version is, you know, I'm at the edge of level two and level three, maybe level four, dancing around that. Trying to figure out how you eventually climb up the ladder of needs. Because you're right, like money is important, but it is not like a primary driver, but it's very hard to articulate what else is the primary driver. Like, it's a mishmash, and yeah, legacy is not a good word, but yeah, it's something in that realm. So yeah, I think those two, I would say, were my big takeaways from our conversation. And yeah, in general, like, I haven't spoken to you in 10 years. So like 13 to be accurate. So just sort of knowing what you've been up to and how life has been for you and the interesting things you're doing. I'm glad that we could have a pretty solid conversation for an hour and a half. I don't think we ever spoke for an hour and a half when you were back in college. So I'm glad we did this.
That's absolutely true, that the listeners will find quite fascinating. I mean, we did like spend quite some time goofing around, like, you know, yes, we got up for the hour. But yeah, I don't think we had this sort of conversation. And Ruben, thank you so much for saying what you felt, because I genuinely, like, I know there was something going on, and I just wanted to know, like, it's given me fodder for thought as well. And I feel good that somewhere there is some sort of communication alignment. Oh my god, this is
anti-drama. Oh my god. If people got to keep up with all the cool stuff you're doing, how should they keep up with you, or how's the best way for them to get in touch?
I think my email, which you have.
Okay, so I'll leave your email in the show notes.
I mean, I don't know, how do people do it here? Like, is there a more
Instagram, LinkedIn? Well, what, yeah, is there any platform you're on? Is there any website people can check out? Or your email will be in the show notes, but anywhere.
Yeah, Instagram, LinkedIn, you know, the general works, I think.
Okay. I caught Priyanka on LinkedIn, so I can attest that channel works. It is available. You can reach out to her there, and she will, hopefully, if she likes you, she'll reply. If not, too bad for you.
Oh, come on. I reply to everyone. And if anyone is in London, if I'm here, then that'd be like, yeah. But this sounds so bad. Like, if anyone's in London, as if like London is like some, I don't know, Chandni Chowk. It's easy. But she's like, wow.
I mean, a lot of people are in London.
Of course, it sounds so bubblish, you know? Like, as if it's like some Connaught Place or Chandni Chowk. You take the yellow line.
If I'm in London, I did hit up a bunch of people who were on the pod. I'm like, hey, you know, I'm in your city. Let's meet. And they were like,
I'm not undermining anybody's capacities, but it's still like, you know, the monster of immigration that you have to cover.
Oh, yes. I agree. Are you planning, for the foreseeable future, will you be in London?
I think I will be here for a couple of years. And then after that, God knows. But at least definitely I'm here till 2025-26.
Okay, great. So depends on when you listen to this pod. You can catch her in London. Until 2025 only. After that, God knows. Okay, with that, we shall wrap this. Priyanka, thank you again for making
time. So nice. Catch up.
Yeah. And that's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review or just follow us on your podcast player. If you'd like to hear more from me, subscribe to our newsletter or follow us on Instagram. You can find all the links in the show notes. I upload new episodes every alternate week, and I'll see you next time.